I think we should get started now. I want to welcome all of you to the second lecture in our year-long Sawyer Seminar lecture series, a series that's generously funded by the Mellon Foundation, co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics, and hosted by the Stanford Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, one of the many centers within the IRIS fold. So it's my honor and pleasure to welcome today Jerry Cohen, the titular professor of social and political theory at All Souls College, Oxford University. As many of you know, he's not only responsible for what is arguably the most famous defense of all of the Marxian narrative of history, but he's also completed an exceedingly influential moral defense of socialism, and in addition has completed a very influential explanation of why it is that people who adhere to egalitarian political principles have or do not have a responsibility to actually live them out. And I might add that latter work or line of work has yielded what I think might be the best title ever for a book, namely, if you're an egalitarian, how come you're so rich? So I'm very pleased then to introduce and welcome Jerry Cohen.
Now all I can think of is what might be a better title. Huckleberry Finn's not so bad. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me. If I can find my lecture, I'll give my lecture. Is this functioning, or is it just... You mean this is functioning and this is functioning?
We can
hear you. When I was a child, I thought it was unfair that the working class family to which I belonged lived a pretty tough life while others had it easy because they were rich. I couldn't see any justification for the difference in fate between me and the rich kids, and I was taught that there wasn't, in fact, any justification for it. The rich didn't, on the whole, work harder or suffer more in their jobs or deserve more. If they got more because they were lucky enough through birth and circumstance to prosper better than my under-equipped parents did in the capitalist market, then that was precisely a result of greater luck. And my belief was and is that it's unfair that some should have more than others because of sheer luck. Maybe not all luck is unfair, but unchosen luck, as opposed to the luck of a deliberate gamble, unchosen luck with respect to people's large-scale life prospects at birth is unfair, whatever we might want to say about whether other sorts of luck, such as the results of a deliberate gamble, are fair. Now, I know that not everybody will agree with the egalitarian line of thinking that I just laid out, and there might even be some people here who don't agree with it. Maybe some of you will have thought that you've just been treated to nothing more than a somewhat self-satisfied assertion of envy. But the great liberal philosopher John Rawls certainly showed plenty of sympathy with the idea that differential unchosen luck is unfair. He showed sympathy with the view which says that the results of the forced lotteries of birth and circumstance are unfair. Although, as we shall see in a moment, he also contrived in the end to turn his back on that foundational egalitarian thought. But before I get into an exposition of Rawls's view and why I disagree with it, I want to say a few things about how I see the significance of the Rawlsian achievement, especially so because I have spent nearly 20 years setting myself against the Rawlsian outlook on justice, and this produces a big need in me to say what's so great about Rawls, both in fairness to him and by way of justifying my own extended focus on his work. According to a story, which may or may not be true, but it doesn't matter because it's a really good story, the Columbia philosopher, Maurice Raphael Cohen, who died in 1947, would give a seminar every year on George Hegel's great work, The Phenomenology of the Spirit. And Cohen's contribution to the seminar proceedings was to criticize Hegel mercilessly, so that the text of the poor old Phenomenology of the Spirit lay ripped to shreds by the end of the semester. One day, when a photograph of the Columbia Philosophy Department was to be taken, Cohen turned up for the photograph with Hegel's Phenomenology under his arm to be displayed in the picture. A surprised colleague said, "But you're always attacking it. Why did you bring that book?" And Cohen answered, "What other book is there?" Now, I feel that way about John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice. I believe that at most two books in the history of Western political philosophy have a claim to be regarded as greater than A Theory of Justice, and they are Plato's Republic and Hobbes's Leviathan. I shall not try to say what I think is great about the Plato and Hobbes books, but among what contributes to the greatness of A Theory of Justice and of the entire Rawlsian achievement is that, to put the matter as Hegel would have put it, had he agreed with me, John Rawls grasped his age, or more precisely, one large reality of his age, in thought. In Rawls's work, the politics of liberal democracy in the American sense and social democracy in the European sense, that politics rises to consciousness of itself in Rawls's work. Now, somebody once said to me that the reason why the thought of John Locke is full of tensions and maybe sometimes contradictions is that Locke saw all the problems. This is a reference to Locke's theory of knowledge. Well, liberal social democracy is certainly not without its problems. And in my opinion, the conflicts and tensions within this ideology and practice surface in the tensions that I claim to find in the Rawlsian architectonic, some of which I'll be trying to expose this evening. A large part of my own work has been an attempt to train a certain powerful egalitarian element in Rawls against the inegalitarian conclusions that Rawls reaches. In the penultimate paragraph of part two of volume one of Das Kapital, Karl Marx said, and this is A on the distributed piece of paper, he said about the capitalist market that there alone rule freedom, equality, property, and Bentham. Meaning by freedom here, the right to choose or reject contractual arrangements, contractual engagements, I'd be better put. Meaning by equality, the lack of status distinctions, with nobody having rights of command over anybody else, but meeting as equals. With property here being understood to include both the capitalist's ownership of capital and the worker's ownership of herself, and therefore of her own labor power. And the fourth element, Bentham, being understood to denote the pursuit of utility maximization. Now, whether or not Marx was right to draw a special connection between those four values and the capitalist market in particular, they are certainly the chief values of our liberal capitalist civilization, and they are the values that therefore occupy our political philosophers. Not all political philosophers are preoccupied with all four of the values, but Rawls was. And the suit he tailored covered all of them, but I would claim, awkwardly and unavoidably so. Rawls was like the tailor in the story that unfortunately some of you probably already know. The tailor in the story, but the customer who comes to collect the suit for which the tailor had measured him up a week earlier. The customer tries on the jacket, and one shoulder seems to be higher than the other. But the tailor says he's not wearing it right, so he pushes it down. He gently pushes down one of the man's shoulders. Then the tailor also makes one of the man's legs do a 30-degree turn because it's not fitting the trouser properly. Finally, the customer, perplexed but compliant, leaves the tailor's shop and makes his awkward way as best he can along the sidewalk. A passing woman says to her husband, "Poor man, what an affliction." And the husband says, "Nice suit, though." Now, chief among the conflicts of value that capitalism displays is that between equality and utility. Its rhetoric endorses both, but its reality sacrifices equality to utility. Capitalism, in my opinion, relies on injustice to produce human happiness. When the NYU philosopher Thomas Nagel wrote in his book, Equality and Partiality, that, and I'm quoting, "Capitalism is wonderful," he didn't explain what he meant, and the sentence jarred me as a person who's critical of capitalism before I saw its point. He did not mean that capitalism was morally attractive, that, as some think, it gives everyone her proper due. He meant rather that it delivers the goods. Now, all responsible contemporary political philosophy must cope with both sides of the truth about capitalism, its dark truth and its brighter truth. The Rawlsian endorsement of inequality as just, when and because it delivers the goods to everyone, is a way of coping that, so I think, masks the conflict that it seeks to resolve. Let me explain why I say that Rawls turned his back on the key egalitarian thought, the one I had as a child, that arbitrarily caused inequalities are unfair, inequalities that don't reflect differential effort or desert, and these are the inequalities that you're going to get unless you intervene in the market process. There is no trace of aversion to inequality as such in Rawls's famous difference principle. The difference principle says, this should have been on the handout, and I apologize for forgetting to put it there, that inequalities are recommended by justice as long as they don't make the worst off people worse off than they would otherwise be. Inequalities are recommended by justice as long as the worse off people in society, in the unequal society, are no worse off than they would otherwise be if you removed the inequality. The principle is strictly indifferent to the presence or absence of inequality in distribution. Let me explain what I mean. Suppose there are two people, A and B, and this is B on the handout, and four possible distributions among them. If you set different wage rates for different activities, four sets of such wage rates, then you will get the four distributions that you see here. And we're assuming, for the sake of exposition, that no other distributions are possible. Now, the difference principle ranks the columns distributions in the order D4 being the best and D1 being the worst. Because the principle assigns priority to the worst off people, it prefers D2 to D1 despite the sacrifice in aggregate welfare or goods that the move from D1 to D2 brings. The D1-D2 preference shows how the difference principle rejects utilitarianism, the maximization of welfare or goods. D3 is preferred to D2 despite the substantial inequality that D3 imports. And D4 is preferred to D3 despite the increase in that inequality that it implies. The gap between one person and another is of no relevance in the assessment of these states of affairs under the difference principle. The difference principle only cares that the worst off person, in this case B, gets as much as it's possible for her to get, regardless of how much the other person gets. Now, Rawls is nevertheless called an egalitarian, and the designation is apt for at least two reasons. First, Rawls certainly comes out egalitarian when his views are located within the extremely anti-egalitarian context of American political belief. Second, even though the difference principle is indifferent to equality as such, it expresses a solicitude, the principle expresses a solicitude about the condition of badly off people that any egalitarian must applaud. Yet Rawls is called an egalitarian not only for those good reasons, but also because of a certain misperception, which has to do with how much inequality the difference principle will in fact permit. That is something which is not knowable a priori. It's a matter for economists in a given context rather than philosophers to figure out what inequality is optimal for the worst off. But it's significant that Rawls's own guess as to that was that there would indeed be a lot of inequality resulting from the implementation of the difference principle. For he could not otherwise say, as he does, that deep inequalities in people's life prospects at birth are inevitable in any society, including, therefore, in the society whose economy is governed by the difference principle that Rawls himself recommends. A decisive clue to how much inequality Rawls thought there would be in his just society is provided by some speculations that he offered about how inequality in the achieved Rawlsian just society would be experienced, what people would feel about it, and in particular, speculations about how the worst off people in society would feel about the fact that they were worse off than everybody else. Excuse me. Rawls speculated that, I quote, differences in wealth and circumstance across social groups would not be very painful for the less well-off because, he said, quote, we tend to compare our circumstances with others in the same or in a similar group as ourselves, unquote. It follows that Rawls expected the inequalities in his just society to be large because there would be no pain from which their isolation would be needed to save the less well-off if inequalities were insubstantial. I want to quote the passage that surrounds Rawls's speculation about who badly off people would compare themselves with at a little length, since it testifies strongly to the presence of substantial inequality in the achieved Rawlsian society. And this is C on your handout. Rawls says, the plurality of associations in a well-ordered society, each with its secure internal life, tends to reduce the visibility, or at least the painful visibility, of variations in men's prospects. For we tend to compare our circumstances with others in the same or in a similar group as ourselves, or in positions that we regard as relevant to our aspirations. The various associations in society tend to divide into so many non-comparing groups, the discrepancy between these divisions not attracting the kind of attention which unsettles the lives of those less well-placed. Taken together, the features of a well-ordered regime diminish the number of occasions when the less favored are likely to experience their situation as impoverished and humiliating. Even if they have some liability to envy, it may never be strongly evoked. Note that Rawls says that the number of occasions for humiliation is diminished in his Just Society. He does not say that humiliating experiences will not occur. And elsewhere in the second quotation, Rawls says that we hope that the observable features of the distribution will fall in a range where they do not seem unjust. This is an argument for, among other things, secluded roads for liberal limousines. If I didn't know that Jack Rawls, the person whom I had the privilege of knowing somewhat, was totally free of cynicism, I would call what he writes here cynical. In fact, I find it really discrepant with his humane attitude to people in society and so forth. It must be that he simply thought that it was that this degree of inequality was unavoidable. He wasn't celebrating it, but he was saying how much there'd be and telling us don't be too upset because it's not going to bug people that much because they won't be rubbing shoulders against one another. Now, so much in demonstration of the extent to which Rawls repudiated economic equality. Let me now present Rawls's argument for departing from equality. Rawls says, yes, we have good reason for starting with equality when we reflect on justice, because the typical causes of inequality are what he calls morally arbitrary. The inequality that they cause is unfair because it has little to do with differential choice and effort. In other words, he starts with the thought that what I was taught as a child about the unfairness of our situation is true. But now suppose that we have an inequality like D4 examples on exhibit, an inequality that makes everybody better off than they would be if everything were distributed equally, so that its removal would make even the worst off people in the inequality worse off. Wouldn't that be a decisive reason in favor of the inequality? And isn't providing productive people material incentives of an unequalizing kind just such an inequality in those cases where enough of their greater productivity may be made to redound to the benefit of the worst off? Suppose that only under the spur of inequality will highly productive types produce enough for the minimum welfare to be 6 rather than 5 or 4.9. It would not only be foolish, it would be cruel to the worst off to forbid that inequality. Now, that is a powerful line of argument in favor of inequality. It can be summarized as displayed in item D on the handout. So we start with a general premise, a major premise, which is a way of stating the difference principle. It says, unchosen inequalities are unjust because they're unfair, unless they're necessary to make the worst off people better off, in which case they're just. But, this is an empirical claim, unequalizing incentive payments to productive people are necessary to make the worst off people better off, so unequalizing incentive payments are just. Now, I was confused when I first confronted this argument, given my own egalitarian convictions. I was confused because on the one hand, I did not want, in the name of justice, to reject the difference principle and sign on to an equality that makes everybody worse off. But on the other hand, it seemed to me that the case for the unfairness of the recommended inequality remains strong. And if it is unfair, how could it be just plain just? It took me a long time to sort out a response to the argument. In my first assault on the argument, in Tanner lectures delivered here at Stanford in 1991, I challenged its second premise. I asked why the inequality in question should be thought necessary to benefit the worst off. And the answer must be that it's necessary only because productive people would be unwilling to be as productive as they are if they got the same wage as everybody else. That's pretty obvious, but it has two important consequences. First, that the inequality isn't really or strictly necessary to make the worse off better off. It's not necessary independently of human will, like a fact of nature. It's necessary only because and insofar as the productive are unwilling to act otherwise. It's their choices that make the inequality necessary. And the second thing that follows from the fact that the inequality is necessary only because productive people would be unwilling to be as productive as they are if they got the same wage as everybody else, is that the productive people act as they do only because they themselves reject the principle that an inequality is justified only if it benefits the worst off. They couldn't act as they do if they themselves, so I argued, a lot of people disagreed, but I said that they couldn't act as they do if they themselves accepted the difference principle. They couldn't act as they do if they acted in conformity with the conception of justice that is stated in the first premise of the argument. So the incentive justification of inequality, I concluded, works only in a society which by Rawlsian criteria is unjust because not everybody in it observes the right principle of justice. How then could the result be justice? How could the better off justify the inequality by saying that it's necessary when they themselves make it necessary? If I make it necessary for you to pay the toll to go through the gate, and there's good reason for you to go through the gate, and you ask me to justify the toll, can I say, well, the toll is necessary for you to be able to go through the gate? A third party can say to me, you ought to pay the toll because otherwise you can't go through the gate. But that is limp on the lips of the person who's actually imposing the necessity. On his or her lips, it's not a piece of justification, but a piece of blackmail. Now, notice that in the remarks that I've made about the second premise of the argument, I have not challenged the difference principle itself. What I challenged is the idea that incentive payments, unequalizing incentive payments, are endorsed by that principle. What I said challenges not the major, but the minor premise, premise two, of the argument presented on your handout. Well, having spent some years on the second premise of the argument without questioning its first premise, it belatedly began to dawn on me that I should also reject the first premise, the difference principle itself. And that's because I came to think that there's an incoherence in the thought behind the principle. You can't make equality the natural starting point or default point for justice on the ground that nobody deserves more than anybody else, and then depart from equality because the departure benefits the worst off, and then declare that the result is unambiguously just. For the result still displays the injustice of arbitrarily caused, luck-infested inequality. It's sheer luck that the productive are productive. The result still displays that injustice, even if it might be claimed that it also shows justice of a different kind because it renders the worst off as well off as possible. Given that justice recommends an equal starting point, the best we can say of the inequality that the difference principle endorses is that it's in one way just because, after all, it makes the worst off as well off as possible, and that's a kind of justice, but in another way unjust because the inequality is undeserved because the benefits that the better off get under the inequality are just sheer luck. Now let me try to suppose that to support that argument against the derivation of the difference principle. Suppose that better off people literally could not produce prodigiously without unequalizing incentives. I supposed in my challenge to the second premise that they could produce for average wages. But suppose they couldn't. Suppose, contrary to what I claimed, that the second premise of the argument is true, because, for example, it's psychologically impossible to produce prodigiously except with a big carrot in prospects. The animal spirits just don't flow unless there's a big price tag on the result. Now, the inequality that incentives bring, though now on this last assumption indeed justified by the difference principle, would remain unjust because of its source in morally arbitrary causes. The original reason for calling inequality unjust would still be there. The incapacity of the talented would explain, but not supply, a morally non-arbitrary justification of incentives inequality. And that puts a taint on the difference principle itself. The principle perceives no injustice whatsoever in unavoidable inequalities that have certain good consequences. But the original condemnation of morally arbitrary inequality was not based on its having bad consequences. The trouble with it was that it was unfair, and it remains unfair, even if nobody can do anything about it. So suppose we contemplate a distribution. We come upon this society, and we see that the distribution is like distribution D. It's 14-6. And we think it unjust because we don't think that anything about the 14 people, the people who have 14, justifies the disparity between them and the people who have 6. Now, in thinking it unjust, our thought is not that the inequality renders the worse-off person worse off than she needs to be. We may think that, too, but that isn't the whole of our thought. So when we discover that 14-6 actually benefits the worse-off person, our reason for thinking 14-6 unjust stands, whether or not we are willing to countenance it as a beneficial injustice, or more moderately, as just in one way and unjust in another. Now, it follows from the case that I presented against the second premise of the Rawlsian argument that a full implementation of the difference principle requires it to be followed not only by the state, but also by citizens at large. Potential high earners must forbear from seizing the advantages that their bargaining power puts within their reach, and that the state cannot efficiently prevent them from seizing. It follows, in a word, from my position, that a full implementation of the difference principle requires the presence across society of an ethos of egalitarian justice, a set of attitudes and dispositions whose effect is to assign priority to the interests of the worst-off people in society. Now, this ethos must be tempered by legitimate self-interested considerations. For each of us has a legitimate personal prerogative. Each of us has the right to be something other than an engine for the welfare of other people. Nobody is obliged to be nothing but a slave to social justice. But the individual who affirms the difference principle, I contend, must have some regard to it in his economic choices, whatever regard that is which starts where his personal prerogative stops. That contradicts Rawls's view, which permits people to make their economic choices in total disregard of the interests of the worst off, provided that the state sets those interests of the worst off as paramount in its economic policy. Even when tempered by recognition of a personal prerogative, my conclusion that a just society requires an egalitarian ethos puts much greater demands on the lives of the better off than does Rawls's lax view of how the difference principle is to be implemented. And so, unsurprisingly, my philosophical embrace of those demands has provoked a number of weighty objections. The first objection that surfaced against my position, the position that is that if you believe in the difference principle, you have to have some substantial regard to it in everyday life. You can't just delegate its operation to the state. The first objection can be called the basic structure objection. It says that principles of justice apply to the basic coercive structure of society alone and not to the choices of citizens within that structure. Because they endorse the difference principle, Conscientious Rawlsian citizens comply with the rules of the coercive structure, but they're not only free, as a matter of fact, but also morally free to choose as they wish within those rules. It's only public decisions, the decisions of the state and of institutions allied to it, which are up for assessment at the bar of justice, and not the decisions within the law of agents acting in their private capacity. But why should one think that justice is thus restricted in its scope? The answer given in Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, is that it's the basic structure, basic coercive structure of society, whose influence on our lives is profound and present from the start. But that's a feeble argument for restricting the purview of justice to the basic structure, because it's certainly not in general true that coercive structure has more impact than social ethos on how much inequality there will be. Ethos has a huge impact on, for example, how progressive taxation can safely be without being counterproductive. Suppose that a country that I shall call Swedeland once had a strong welfare state that greatly benefited the worst off, but that the Swedeland state taxed its financially more successful people at rates against which the upper and middle classes in time rebelled through various forms of literal and internal emigration, to the detriment principally of the worst off, as the tax take and therefore the welfare state sagged. Now, some people think that story is true of Sweden, but I say Swedeland to cater for dissidents on that score. Whether or not the story is true of some actual state, it's not only coherent but credible, and its credibility suffices to demonstrate the extreme importance of the presence or the absence of the ethos for which I contend. A distinct objection to my view that the difference principle has to have some incidence in the choices in everyday life of the people who profess to affirm it has been pressed by the Welsh philosopher Andrew Williams. According to Williams, principles of social justice are principles that we fulfill collectively. A given individual person is not obliged to observe a principle of social justice unless others are doing so. Accordingly, the individual can't be expected to observe principles of justice. She can't be obliged to observe them unless she can be assured that others too are observing them. But she can't be assured that others are observing them unless she can tell whether others are observing them. And she can't tell whether others are appropriately observant unless the principle in question issues a precise and unambiguous instruction. But, Williams continues, the egalitarian ethos, properly tempered by a personal prerogative, is, as I would amply concede, vague and general in its directive, and not at all precise. It requires people to have appropriate regard to the worst off in their economic decisions, but within the limits of a reasonable personal prerogative, and that prescription, Williams urges, is too vague to count as a demand of justice. Now, I've laid out the Williams argument. It's just a stepwise presentation of what I said, what I just finished saying. I'm not going to go through it because I don't want to. I hate lectures that last more than an hour, and I hate doing to other people what I don't want them to do to me. So this one will be less than 1 hour. 59 something or other. But anyway, I have objections to each of the premises in the Williams argument, but I'm going to restrict myself to some remarks about the third premise of the argument, which says you can't be assured that others are complying with an obligation unless you know precisely what it means to comply with that obligation, so that you can check whether others are indeed complying with it. Well, contrary to that third premise, we can know that good faith effort on behalf of a principle obtains broadly in a society, even when people's obligations under that principle are not precisely defined or even definable. During the Second World War in Britain, a social ethos, induced people to sacrifice personal interests for the sake of the effort, and everybody was expected, as a matter of justice, to, in the phrase that prevailed, to do his bit, to shoulder his just share. But no one could have stated precisely what amount of sacrifice that injunction required. And it's true, therefore, that with respect to many people, one couldn't tell, and with respect to some, they couldn't even themselves tell whether they were sacrificing on the required scale. There are too many details in each person's life that affect what the required sacrifice should be. Max has a bad back. Sally has a difficult child. George has just inherited £20,000. Yes, Jack goes out only once a week, not like most of us twice, on guard duty, but then Jack has to take care of his mother. So these variations in people's circumstances, unmeasurable as they are, for more than one reason, produce imprecision in our conception of what the obligation of individuals should be. But the extent to which individuals conform to the requirements of sacrifice could certainly be known in rough and ready terms. The sacrifice ethos was amenable to sufficient rough and ready public checkability for social assurance. People who engaged in the relevant sacrifice could know that they weren't being suckers, people who were doing it when other people weren't. Despite its vagueness, do your bit was understood and applied as a principle of justice. It would have been crazy to have asked for it to be carefully defined, but it would also be crazy to deny that it performed a task of social regulation in the interest of justice. And all of that, I think, can be said mutatis mutandis about the egalitarian ethos that I claim to be required for justice. Now, as I've thus far envisaged its effect, the egalitarian ethos operates within and at the margins of what might remain a basically market capitalist society. The ethos affects decisions about investment paths, employment policies of firms, responses to rates of taxation, of market income, and so forth. The ethos modifies market behavior. It does not replace it. But can we proceed more comprehensively beyond the market to a form of economy whose functioning is egalitarian at its heart without colossal loss of efficiency? It was relatively easy during the Second World War in Britain to recruit people to various forms of home guard and similar service. While the bounds of each person's obligation may have been obscure, the overall task was urgent and well-defined. It was easy to draw on generosity and a sense of fairness in the given urgent context. None of that spoils the particular use that I made a moment ago of the World War II example, because the example certainly proves that the demands of justice need not be precisely statable. But the very special circumstances of war mean that what happened in Britain during the war can be invoked only with great care as a model for conceiving a trans-market socialist society in which people serve each other in true reciprocity. The feasibility of altruistic war contributions doesn't prove that an economy based on giving, an economic system that satisfies the old slogan, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, is possible. And the attempt to forsake the market in favor of a planned egalitarian society in the Soviet Union and elsewhere was disastrous. Before proceeding further, in closing, with the question whether a non-market economy is possible, I pause to explain what I mean by people serving one another in true reciprocity. True reciprocity, or as you might more neutrally call it, communal reciprocity, is the anti-market principle according to which I serve you not because of what I can get in return, but because you need my service. And you, for the same reason, serve me. Communal reciprocity is not the same thing as market reciprocity, since the market motivates productive contribution not on the basis of commitment to one's fellow human beings and a desire to serve them while being served by them, but on the basis of cash reward. The immediate motive to productive activity in a market society is typically some mixture of greed and fear in proportions that vary with the details of a person's market position and personal character. In greed, other people are seen as possible sources of enrichment, and in fear, they are seen as threats. These are horrible ways of seeing other people, however much we have become habituated and inured to them as a result of centuries of capitalist civilization. Now, I said that the attempt to institute a planned egalitarian society whose economy manifested true reciprocity was disastrous. And many infer from that disaster that any such socialism is infeasible. But there are two contrasting reasons why socialism might be thought infeasible, and it's very important, both intellectually and politically, to distinguish them. The first reason has to do with human motivation, and the second has to do with what could be called social technology. The first putative reason why socialism might be thought infeasible is that people are, so it is often said, by nature insufficiently generous and cooperative to meet its requirements, however generous and cooperative they may be, under a common threat of war and extinction. The second putative reason says very differently that even if people are or would be sufficiently generous, we don't know how to harness that generosity. We don't know how, through appropriate rules and stimuli, to make generosity turn the wheels of the economy. Contrast human selfishness, which we know how to harness very well. In my view, but this is just my view, I give no argument for it, the principal problem that faces the socialist ideal is that we don't know how to make the machinery that would make the ideal work. Our problem is not primarily human selfishness, but our lack of a suitable organizational technology. Our problem is a problem of design. It may be an insoluble design problem, and it's a design problem that's undoubtedly exacerbated by our selfish propensities, but a design problem, so I think, is what we've got. Selfishness and generosity exist, after all, in everyone, or almost everyone. Our problem is that while we know how to make an economic system work on the basis of selfishness, we don't know how to make it work on the basis of generosity. Yet even in the real world, in our own society, a great deal depends on generosity, or to put it more generally and more negatively, on non-market incentives. Doctors, nurses, teachers, and others don't, or don't comprehensively, gauge what they do in their jobs according to the amount of money they're likely to get as a result in the way that capitalists and workers in non-caring occupations do. And the reason for the difference is not that carers are made of morally superior clay, but in good part the more cognitive reason that their conception of what is to be produced is given by human need. Market signals are not necessary to decide what diseases to cure or what subjects to teach, nor are they good at deciding that. But once we pass out of the sphere of need, or more generally, out of the sphere of what economists call merit goods, to the wide sphere of optional commodities, and we pass increasingly to that as economies progress and as life therefore becomes easier and more elegant, it's more difficult to know what to produce and how to produce it without the device of market signals. Very few socialist economists would now dissent from that proposition. The technology for using base motives to productive economic effect is reasonably well understood, and the history of the 20th century strongly confirms the thought that the easiest way to generate productivity in a modern society is by nourishing the motives of greed and fear in a hierarchy of unequal income. But we should never forget that greed and fear are repugnant motives. Who would propose running a society on the basis of such motives and thereby promoting the psychology to which they belong if they were not known to be effective, if they did not have the instrumental value, which is the only value that they have? In his famous statement, in which Adam Smith justified market relations, he pointed out that we place our faith in the butcher's generosity, we place our faith not in the butcher's generosity, but in his self-interest when we rely on him to provision us. Smith thereby propounded a wholly instrumental justification of market motivation in face of what he acknowledged to be its unattractive intrinsic character. Old-style socialists often ignored Adam Smith's point in a moralistic condemnation of market motivation which failed to address its instrumental justification. Certain contemporary over-enthusiastic so-called market socialists tend, contrariwise, to forget that the market is intrinsically repugnant because they are blinded by their belated discovery of the market's instrumental value. The genius of the market, this is F on the handout, is that it recruits low-grade motives to desirable ends, but it also produces undesirable effects, including significant unjust inequality. In a balanced view, all three sides of that proposition must be kept in focus, as the first two indeed were by the pioneering 18th century writer Bernard Mandeville, whose market-praising Fable of the Bees is subtitled Private Vices, Public Benefits. Many contemporary celebrants of the market play down the truth in the first half of that subtitle. The socialist aspiration is to bring our economic life under the principle of community. As I have acknowledged, we now know that we don't now know how to do that. And many think that we now know that it's impossible to do that. But community conquests in certain domains, such as healthcare and education, have sustained viable forms of production and distribution in the past. And it's imperative now to defend community. This may have more application to Britain than it does to the United States, since community is a value that's currently under aggressive threat from the market principle, and also because there's often immediate political mileage to be got from reasserting community in the mentioned particular domains. I agree with Albert Einstein that socialism is humanity's attempt to overcome and advance beyond the predatory phase of human development. The argument, the market is an organized system of predation, albeit, as I've amply acknowledged, a highly productive system. Humanity's attempt to get beyond predation has thus far failed, but I don't think the right conclusion is to give up. Thank you very much. Do we have questions? Yeah, questions. Okay, let people. What? This is good enough. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I haven't thought about it very much, I mean, despite the emphasis that I put on it. But I mean, the difficulty is if you're going to be a good producer of shoes, you have to respond to market signals, because shoes are things that people should have according to their tastes and varying needs and so on and so forth, right? I mean, unless you're in a society, if you're in a society which is very poor, then you can treat shoes the way you treat healthcare. If it's very poor, you know, and people, that the thing is to stop people being barefoot, then in a Stalinistic way, you know what to do. You produce the elementary requirements of a decent existence. But actually, that society wasn't so bad in producing certain elementary requirements in the health and education field. But it was awful at trying to produce things that would enrich and enhance people's lives because of the lack of response to consumer demand. So you have to, if you're going to respond to consumer demand, you're going to respond to market signals, and then the criterion of your success is going to be how much money that you make, in a way that's not going to be the criterion of success for a hospital unit that deals, let's say, provides neonatal care for premature babies, right? Now, it is logically possible. This is the burden of, there's a book that was published in 1981, which I think is a very important book, but it hasn't had the impact that I think it deserves, partly because of certain unattractive expositional features. The central idea is extremely interesting. The book is called Equality, Moral Incentives, and the Market. It was published by the University of Chicago Press in 1981. The author is called Joseph Cairns, and the subtitle of the book is An Essay in Utopian Economic Theory. And what he does is he describes a society where, if you landed from Mars, you'd think it was a capitalist society, because there are capitalists and who hire workers, and the capitalists are trying to make profit, and everything functions in exactly the way that we're familiar with. But the state appropriates all income through taxation and then redistributes income equally. So there you have, I mean, the point of the exercise is to get all the information function of the market in place while utterly extinguishing the motivational function. And I suppose in real life there is some degree of approximation to that when people react differentially to higher taxes that are intended to support welfare programs, and it's within their feasible set to reduce their labor input in the face of higher taxes, but they don't, right? So that's the Keynesian motivation on a small scale. And there are problems about exactly how people would be motivated and how they would know how much to work and so on. And but there's a little literature which was also contributed to by two books that followed it. One by Martin Wilkinson called, I think it's called Efficiency, Freedom, and the Market, or something like that. Efficiency, Freedom, and Equality. It was a Routledge book. And then there's a book called The Civic Minimum by Stuart White. And what they all try to do in different ways, and I'm afraid I can't give you a resume of what's said, is to design exactly how the agent in that market society would govern herself, because if they're going to go for absolute maximum profit, because profit represents social value, then they'll work till they drop, and you don't want that. So I don't know if that's one direction of exploration, right?
I'd like to ask a question about what I think of as the most novel thing in the talk you gave relative to your earlier work, which is the rejection of the difference principle, even in a world where, you know, it's psychologically impossible to behave generously. I just want to try and press some of the Rawlsian intuition back at you about the least well-off, which is, you know, we can conceive of a fairness in a pairwise comparison, say, between two states of affairs as that which, you know, the person who's least well-off in that pairwise comparison would prefer. So, you know, it seems like if you reject the difference principle in favor of full equality, then your argument entails that either D2 or D3 in your set of examples is preferable in a pairwise comparison to D4. But it seems like that violates a really strong intuition. Not even B would choose D2 or D3 over D4, absent, you know, some complicated argument about positional goods or something, which hasn't been provided. I mean, how do you answer that sort of basic Rawlsian intuition?
Well, although there was some deficiency in the presentation, which I would have corrected had I noticed it earlier, I didn't actually reject the difference principle. What I rejected was the Rawlsian argument for the difference principle. And that had certain consequences for how you characterize the situation where you implement the difference principle. So what I said was, the Rawlsian argument is, there's nothing in the causes of inequality, no matter how inequality is caused, that's going to justify it. It's going to be unfair. But there could be something about the consequences of inequality, namely that it redounds to the benefit of the worst off, that nevertheless makes it just. And my argument was not so much against the principle itself as against that argument, saying if you start from saying that inequality will always show a certain unfairness, that unfairness will remain even if some people are going to benefit from the inequality. And therefore, you can't characterize the society which is tailored to the difference principle as quite simply just. You have to say it's just in... there are two things you could say. The more anti-Rawlsian thing is it's unjust, but it's beneficial, so we choose it, right? And the alternative more friendly to Rawls, but nevertheless still rejecting what he says, is that it's just in one way and unjust in another. So I don't have to face exactly the challenge that you presented. But look at it this way. Suppose you have a community of people who have equal amounts of stuff. They're completely equal. And then manna falls from heaven on the plot of one of these people, on Jane's plot, right? This manna can only be consumed by Jane. It's not shiftable to anybody else. Either she consumes it or she destroys it. Assume that she destroys it. And people say, why did you destroy it? You know, it didn't harm any of the rest of us that you should have it. And she said, well, I just think it's not fair that I should have it for no good reason when you don't. Now, if you think she's simply being an idiot, then you disagree with me. I think she's being a remarkably just person. And I'm not sure that I want to say that the state should take it away from her. Maybe the state isn't entitled to do something which isn't going to benefit anybody, but is going to harm somebody. But I certainly, my intuitive conception of justice, there's a form of justice that she is responding to, which the difference principle doesn't acknowledge.
It seems, briefly follow up, I mean, it seems like in that question, if we sort of take the interests of the other landholders or whoever they are in this scenario, it seems like on a sort of simplistic interpretation of events, they'd be indifferent between the state of affairs where the manna falls on Jane and the manna doesn't. So I mean, I think,
That is simplistic. That is simplistic.
What I'm asking is, I mean, are you committed to the claim that the other people are not indifferent between the situation where Jane gets the manna and the situation where Jane doesn't get the manna, if their own endowments are, you know, otherwise unchanged?
I'm not building a model here, right? I mean, there are various assumptions you can make about that. The truth is that people will vary in their attitudes to it, right? For example, their mere indifference doesn't establish what you might want to conclude, Suppose that I'm, as we say in Britain, queuing for something or other, right? And somebody pushes in front. And I'm a generous person, really laid back. This is very much counterfactual assumption, but suppose, you know, that I'm very laid back. I'm very laid back about this, right? I really don't mind. So I let them go ahead because it really doesn't make much difference to me. If I may have a certain disdain for them, I feel, you know, but if it matters so much to you, I'm not going to make a fuss. Well, I'm indifferent to their getting it, this unjust advantage, but I would nevertheless judge it unjust. So I don't think that the issue of how, of whether people would care in a certain way establishes that. You have to start from, I believe that you start from intuitive raw material, and the issue here is, that's going to divide us, or divide some, is whether her behavior is in any way admirable. And if it's admirable, in what way is it admirable? And I think it's admirable, as the French would say, sous la signe de justice. I think it's admirable as a certain kind of response to a demand of justice. But it doesn't follow that at the policy level, I reject the difference principle and tell government to cancel the these things. Yes, woman.
I think this is a follow-on question. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about why equality is the just outcome in your mind. It seems to me there's, you know, we can all agree, I'm certainly happy to agree, that the distributive outcomes we observe from the market are morally arbitrary, and that other outcomes might well be justifiable. But how do you get from there in your own mind to the assumption that the, you know, equality is in fact a just solution?
Well,
I mean, we have intuitions of why it's unjust to butt into line, and if that were the topic of today's discussion, we could try to flesh them out. So I guess I'm asking what the intuitions are that equality is an intrinsically good end, irrespective of people's desires with respect to distribution.
I can't give you a satisfactory answer, except, well. There's nothing more fundamental in my thinking and the thinking of people like me who don't exhaust the human race than the thought that one person being better off than another as a result of luck is unfair. Now, not everybody agrees with that. I know that. Some people are left cold by the thought, and that is a big problem. I mean, the alternative, there's a fundamental alternative view, which is that each person is the sovereign owner, morally speaking, of her own capacities and powers, and is therefore entitled to get whatever he or she can through the contracts that they make with other people. Now, I call that the principle of self-ownership, and I call the contrary thing that I believe the luck egalitarian principle. And neither side in that fundamental divide knows how to refute the position of the other side. And all the intellectually worthwhile debate is, as it were, of a second order, like, people charge egalitarianism with having certain consequences, which you then try to show that it doesn't, or people charge the other side, and so forth. I can't convince somebody who doesn't have that intuition.
To the absolute conditions of the people
Well, I think there is, again, I won't be able to give you a summary of it, but there's a, I mean, if you were talking more than within the egalitarian, general egalitarian camp, there is some quite recent work which attacks prioritarianism on behalf of pure egalitarianism. I mean, I could mention people, but unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to give a summary of what they say. But let me see if I can say anything more satisfactory. No, you're absolutely right. No, you're wrong. You're right. That was an inappropriate response to your question. It's not true that the only competitor view is self-ownership. There is the alternative view, which just doesn't care about inequality as such, and says that all that matters is making the worst off people as well off as possible, and then the next worst off, and so forth.
Or trying to bring people up to a reasonable level of well-being, and not be so sensitive or care that much about inequalities past that point.
Well, I don't think that's a sustainable position, because that point, the point of a reasonable level of well-being, is either so high that indifference to how people stack up below it seems unintuitive, or so low that indifference to how people stack up above it is unintuitive. I mean, if you set it at bare subsistence, then you're still going to want, contrary to your profession, that what matters is bringing people up to a decent level, to redistribute from, you know, people who are 50% above subsistence to those who are 25% above. And if you make it a decent, comfortable middle-class life, you're going to want to you're going to have redistributive sentiments below the level, below that level. I don't think the sufficiency point of view is sustainable.
Well, maybe I'll let other people speak, but I think maybe part of the problem is whether we're talking about equality of material resources or we're talking about people's sense of well-being. And you know, most of the arguments about equality, most of what you said today really went to the distribution of material resources. And I think many people have an intuition that over a certain threshold, the incremental value of incremental resources on people's happiness, well-being, is relatively trivial compared to other factors. So maybe that's part of it.
Well, I wouldn't agree that, I mean, I put it that way because it's the simplest way to put it, and because I didn't want to get into the incredibly complicated question of whether we're talking about welfare or resources. But I think the argument wouldn't change if you changed the metric. Gentleman over there, yeah.
This may be a terminological question, but you're egalitarian, or sort of egalitarian, you suggested would be engaged in, if we could get the design right, a kind of true or communal, I think you used those two interchangeably, reciprocity. And the question is why reciprocity? Why not simply altruism? Because reciprocity, or especially communal reciprocity, suggests, I take it, some kind of an expectation of return from somebody else within a community. Community, I take it, unless we're going to be stretching the concept to the point of incoherence, is something that has bounds around it. That there is some community outside of it. And so that reciprocal community has a, almost invariably going to end up, even if we get a perfectly egalitarian outcome within it, it's going to be unequal relative to other communities that are reciprocally bound. And so the question is then, why not simply egalitarianism that says perfect altruism such that I give until everybody else is equal to myself?
Well, I think there's a 2x2 matrix here, and that you're supposing otherwise. I think that we can distinguish between altruism on the one hand and what I call reciprocity on the other, as you recognize, right? You can have... Now, the reciprocity that I understand here is that the person wants to give to other people, but wants other people to give to her within, very importantly, the limits of their capacity, right? So nobody expects comparable return from someone who has infirmities and so forth, right? But they don't want to be what in game theory is called a sucker, namely somebody who gives but doesn't get, right? So you ask me, the question, why not altruism rather than that, is, it seems to me, and contrary to the line of questioning, orthogonal to the question of whether the principle, whichever one it may be, is to prevail in our community or globally. So you were asking me why this rather than this, and it seemed to me that you thereby were eliding certain distinctions. I mean, there are two questions. They are quite separate questions. One, why reciprocity rather than altruism? Well, you know, for polemical purposes, obviously reciprocity is a weaker position by contrast with market motivation to altruism, right? But it suffices for socialist purposes. So polemically, presentationally, that's what I focus on, right? But if you say to me, isn't this the correct view? I actually don't think it is, but I don't have very strong views about why it isn't, right? I mean, I do think that there's no obligation to be a saint, namely to serve people who have no inclination to serve you in return, right? But B, I think it may even be completely uncalled for and inappropriate and undignified to serve other people who can serve you too, but who don't do anything. So that's the best I can say in favor of reciprocity. As for just our community or globally, I have absolutely no, I haven't thought much about this. You know, there's a big debate in political philosophy as between those who are cosmopolitans and those who aren't, and my sympathies are on the cosmopolitan side, so I would tend to be over here rather than over here, right? But I haven't thought much about it. You know, I've been too busy thinking about other things.
So your communal reciprocity would be a global.
Yeah, there's no reason for it not to be. There's no reason for it not to be. Yeah. Yes.
You drew a contrast between a situation where people do things for other people because they profit from it, and a situation where people do things for other people because the other people need those things to be done for them.
And the other people are similarly willing to. Yeah.
Okay. So the difficulty that arises, it seems to me, in imagining such a situation or figuring out how it could be achieved is in how you would understand what the needs of the other person were. So I can imagine two possibilities. One is that there is some objective way of determining what the other person's needs are, and the other is that you would just take as the true situation what the other person stated that their needs were. But I think either you or I could give some very, very difficult problems in using either of those criteria that may, in fact, make them impossible criteria to use. So if that's true, if we cannot use either an objective or a subjective account of what the needs are in such a situation, how could you ever implement such a situation, such a way of arranging people's dealings with one another?
Well, actually, this exposes I can't think of the English word for it, but a kind of slippage in the exposition of the paper. There's an error here because on the one hand, I said that there were that one of the great